behalf of the oil companies here, for my, we're just trying to work our way through this disaster. But basically, it depends a lot, I suppose, in the case of Northern California, how we clean up this mess we've made in Alaska would be one thing that might be helpful to your constituents when they consider half of the oil companies here. For my, we're just trying to work our way through this disaster. But basically, it depends a lot, I suppose, in the case of Northern California, how we clean up this mess we've made in Alaska would be one thing that might be helpful to your constituents when they consider development, even if they consider it. You have natural seeps along that coast. I guess you don't go down to Santa Barbara. Maybe you do. I don't know your district. But you have natural seeps right off of Santa Barbara. You may have seen them. I've seen them many times. Oil just keeps bubbling up. The fish life and all the wildlife around there are it's terrific, you know. They had the great Santa Barbara spill back in the late 60s, I suppose. It actually cleaned up much more rapidly than people thought it would. If I lived there, I wouldn't want, I'd probably have the same kinds of problems, but we're talking about the chairman's state probably doesn't want the problems that they've had, but some in this country, we just got to do some of this stuff in our own backyard, so to speak. I think that in the case of California, I think the results have been pretty good out there. There have been spills there, but there have not been, to my knowledge, real lasting damage. But it's a difficult question, and I can be sympathetic with the people and you for asking that question.
I know in Alaska you had about 3 days of relatively calm weather to clean, to at least get a good head start on this spill, and from what other witnesses have said, that didn't happen. Up our way, we never have 3 days of calm weather out there.
Well, I've answered that question, but I'll answer it again. The facts are we were prepared on Saturday morning, which was consistent with the contingency plan, to spray the material, the dispersant, to greatly mitigate the spill. We had a spill that varied between 4 miles and 6 miles across. We were not permitted to do so until 6:45 on Sunday. That's the 2 days. By then, the weather went out, and I know what you're talking about, your weather. But part of the contingency plan all along with a large spill was that you had to use this dispersant, or a dispersant. This happened to be Corexit 9527. It's approved for use in your state, which is no mean feat in terms of toxicity and so forth, as you know better than I do.
Well, could I ask you, Mr. Rawl, one other question? You have indicated that Exxon's paid into the liability fund, which of course is true. But under the law, both Exxon and the fund together are only strictly liable for $100 million. You have to pay the first $14 million, and then the fund would pay the remaining $86 million. But even the fund would raise a defense against paying for any of this accident based on Exxon's negligence. I'm not concerned about what the whole legal picture is, but I am concerned about these fishermen up there and these others that really need money right now. Are they going to have to wait while you're fighting with the fund?
No, sir. I also answered that earlier. We have 30 people in a claims office in Valdez, and when someone comes in, and you know, and the fund's got nothing to do with it. We're paying the claims. We're not waiting for a fund. But let me say one other thing. There's a lot of focus in both sides of the House on that particular fund, and that's part of an insurance situation. The facts are we have claims office there. We're paying people now money against the time it takes to process a claim, but they'll have to have a valid claim, obviously. But also, that $100 million is only the cap on that particular insurance policy. So we're not talking about that law limits our liability to $100 million, and we only have to pay the first 14.
Well, I think in this sense you've been exemplary. I mean, if Exxon sticks with that, which I'm sure you will, then I think you've proven to all of us that you intend to do right by these people who really are the ones that are suffering the most from this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. The chair now recognizes the gentleman from Michigan, Mr. Hertel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Seems to me that
I want to get back to what appears to be a contingency When you talked about the disbursement decisions and the whole discussion there, it seems to me that there wasn't as much knowledge as there should have been about this kind of a contingency as to the use of the disbursements in the water. Could you comment more on that?
I didn't quite understand. I'm a little trouble hearing down here. I don't know what acoustics or what.
When they talked about the disbursement decision and whether it should be made and the calm waters when it was attempted.
Oh,
and all
I see.
That.
Okay, I did. Oh, I missed a couple of words in there. Actually, the material is effective in cold water, warm water, calm water, or rough water. Now, it's not as effective in cold water or very smooth water as it would be in warm water, but when I'm talking effective, let's assume it has 100% effectiveness, and if it's 40 degrees as that sound is, and if the water happened to be smooth, it'd be 80% effective. That means you just apply more of it. It's non-toxic relative to oil. It's essentially no toxicity. There's a little toxicity, but not, you know, by a factor or two magnitudes less toxic than crude oil. It disperses this material into little globules, microscopic almost, and permits biodegradation, and it stays in the upper reaches of the water column. It doesn't fall to the bottom as tar and some of the things that I've heard and read. Now, and it's been tested many places. There was a big Ixtoc blowout off of Mexico where, you know, literally millions of barrels blew out of those wells in the Gulf of Mexico. There's a shrimping industry and so forth. This material was used there and was very effective. It's been used in a lot of places. I mentioned earlier it's approved in California. It's approved in Canada. It's approved in 12 other countries around the world, and it's been around since 1970. But it's been improved all the time. But it's I've heard it said that it's not good on Alaskan crude. That's one of the best crudes to use it on because it has sort of natural material in it that's in this regard. So the point I'm making is that I've heard a lot of that too, but what we ran into here on Saturday was that we ran into the point that we had to have authority to apply this material. We got authority to do a test, and what I'm saying is it's already been approved by the EPA and a number of other people. And yeah, but to test. But why do you have to test? You know, we should have just gotten on with it. But that's all right. We did a test. It worked. But then we were told, well, the water's too calm. Well, the water wasn't. The water was a Beaufort number of 3 to 4, which is excellent for this. And that, but there were some people in there, and I mentioned it to the committee earlier, Congressman, that it's just difficult. It's nice to do tests, and it's nice to say, here's the contingency plan. But when you get 200,000 barrels of oil in the water and you have to get a bunch of people that have to check with each other and talk back to the legislature or talk to Nome or Juneau or wherever they talk to, or undoubtedly Washington, and those days are passing and those hours are passing, one thing I'd ask this committee to consider is how do you focus if authority, and I can understand why they just don't give authority to Exxon to go out and start dumping stuff on the water. But if authority is required, you got to centralize it somewhere. I don't know who or how, but it would seem to me that, and we've had this experience in other parts of the world, where once you got centralized authority with the narrow windows of opportunity you have, you do a heck of a lot better than you don't.
So the contingency plans didn't provide for centralized authority.
Well, it provides, and I can understand why you do this. I mean, I'm understand the political ramifications of it.
Was activated immediately.
It's in a state, and this is the federal government. In order to get the darn thing passed or something, you got to make some kind of. But somehow or another, I would hope that we could work that part of the problem.
Now, in your written statement, you said that the contingency plan was activated immediately, and the two-phase response, and your response was a second phase, and your response was immediate and thorough.
Well, what you have to understand about the contingency plan was that it describes what you have to do in a certain period of time, and you have to have the team on the ground in 24 hours and a number of other things. The material there, we were in a position within 24 hours to start spraying. Of course, it was the middle of the night, so that wasn't exactly right. But we were ready on Saturday morning to start spraying material. And I'm not trying to tell you that this material, when sprayed on that oil, would have taken the problem away. It would have greatly mitigated the problem.
But then Sunday, Monday morning, we couldn't even get up for that.
By Sunday night, where we lost those days, we ended up with gale force winds, 70-mile winds at Valdez, blew the roof off the hangar and a number of other problems. But then Sunday, Monday morning, we couldn't even get up with aircraft, and then we got... And, of course, this oil...
Critical period.
That was a critical period. Oil also weathers. You know, if you just let it lay out there, if it wasn't blown around, about 40% of it would have been gone anyway.
How much does Exxon spend on research into combating this type of a spill, oil spill?
I really don't know the number. It's we've done a lot of it, and we train people at, I think it's Texas A&M has a number of schools a year. We keep a large, we have over 1,000 people worldwide that are trained in various aspects of spills. Most of them, we would hope, would be, you know, a barrel when a hose breaks or something like that, but you have to stay on top of it. We've done a lot of research and technical things that apply to this type of thing.
Those numbers for the committee?
The specific numbers on every, or I can give you
dollars.
Research numbers. We spend about $600 million a year on research, and a large part of it has certain facets of it that apply to this sort of thing. But I can certainly get those numbers to the committee.
You know about the question about volunteers being permitted. It says by Sunday at 9 a.m., you had 100 people, Exxon had 100 people on cleanup operations with 200 on standby. What do you mean by standby? Where were those extra 200?
You heard from they were in the right standing by right there. You know, we were talking about what day at 9 a.m. Sunday? Yeah, well, we had people available to do this spraying and so forth, and planes and all that sort of thing.
Now, we had testimony from a fisherman, and I know that you heard from a lot of them. Why is it the company's policy not to allow the volunteers to participate at an earlier time?
It's not a company policy. And the basic problem we've had, we have a lot of our own employees who would like to go to Alaska, and a lot of people who have volunteered. We're using as many of those fishermen as we can. When I talked to Congressman Young about this, that situation. What we have, though, initially, you have a very dangerous situation with when it's close to the ship and oil vaporizing and so forth. But also, it's a very rocky place. And it's not as if you have a nice sand beach that's been fouled. And the risks are great. We've had no deaths on the ship or anything else. We've had no major injuries that I've heard of. It's a very difficult place to get around in. We're talking about you're cleaning beaches off of boats, and the tide in this bay or in this sound is 15 feet, which is much larger than most of us in the lower 48 are used to looking at. And it's if you fell into it when it was going out, you'd be either a good swimmer or a fast boat to have to get a hold of you. This is a very dangerous place to operate. Now, we're using all the Alaskans we can, and now we got that ship out of there, or at least where we can have a temporary repairs or where we can get into a shipyard somewhere, we can use more people. But volunteers, per se, we're concerned about their safety, basically.
I understand some sailors, some fishermen wanted to take booms out, and they were refused the opportunity to participate.
Well, I don't know about it. I tell you, I've heard a lot of things that after I really got on some people were not verifiable. But, you know, there are a lot of people very angry about this, and you can't blame them for that. But we now have utilized all the fishing boats that we can possibly utilize, and we've utilized a lot of these fishermen. Thank you.
As has been pointed out, and he obviously never predicts such a tragedy, but that it could have even been worse. It could have even been worse. There could have been even more damage done. There could have even been a loss of life. Obviously, the contingency plans were not contingent on anything, and this tragedy is terrible it is. in the history of our country could even have been worse. That's how outrageous the planning had been and investment had been.
I thank the gentleman. In fact, the gentleman from Alaska pointed out to me if the winds had been in the opposite direction, damage in Prince William Sound would have been a lot worse as well than apparently it is now. Thank the gentleman for his contributions. Mrs. Bentley wanted to return for another question, Mr. Rowe. Ms. Bentley.
Mr. Rowe, I know that these last 2 weeks have been a nightmare for you, and it always seems that it's some tragedy that forces us to make changes. I had, as it happened 2 years ago, I had a very serious, a real tragedy in my district when the Amtrak trains crashed and we lost 16 lives. And from that, some good is developing. Hopefully from this, there'll be some good developing. And I do want to say that I have known many of your crews over the years, and they've always been very responsible and have always acted with a great deal of responsibility. And I want to commend you for your forthrightness here today. I just want to get back to our double bottoms a little bit and our ship, the Jones Act ships a little bit. This vessel right now, you're having some problems with as to where you're going to take it for repair. Because everybody's a little sensitive to the fact that it might leak.
There's have only one yard that can do it in the U.S., and they don't. Apparently, the governor of Oregon doesn't want to do it. We'll get it done in the Far East, probably.
All right, if you take it to the Far East, as I understand it, you're going to have to replace a large portion of the bottom, maybe well over 50% of the plates. This is something I've heard.
I haven't heard that.
Yeah, if that happens.
Yeah, I'm sure it does.
If that happens, the ship will not be qualified to be a Jones Act ship anymore.
If we take it to the Far East?
I think so.
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, I'm mentioning this to you at this point.
Well, I appreciate that.
You need to look at that. If you intend to keep it on that run, you need to look at that and maybe work out a way of having that ship repaired somewhere in this country, whether you take it offshore and finish taking the oil out and putting
it in. Well, I don't think it's so much, I think what the basic problem is, Congressman.
We'd like to have it at Sparrow's Point, I'll tell you that now.
Yeah, I know you would. I'd like to put it up here, but it's a long way around.
I know.
And it's a slow process with it. But appreciate your comment. I was not aware of what that potential.
Yes.
I have hopes that the people in Oregon will decide that they want those jobs and will do the work. And if we get the repairs done properly, the temporary repairs, there's no spill potential there.
Yeah.
You know, we're not talking about spilling any more oil going on the way to Washington. I mean, Oregon. For Washington.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
For all, again, we appreciate your testimony. I think I concur with many of the statements made here today. We respect the difficult time you're in personally and with the company, and we also deeply respect the sincerity and the sentiments you've expressed today in terms of your corporation's willingness to do everything possible to mitigate these damages. I'd like to point out to you that you've heard some comment today about this tragedy spilling over into other issues such as ANWR and offshore development. And I don't think there's any denying that this tragedy has indeed caused some political problems for those issues. I want to point out, however, that whether or not we open up ANWR and whether or not we open up offshore areas in addition to the Gulf of Mexico to extensive drilling, we are going to have to transport oil to America from somewhere. We may have to transport more if we fail to develop our own resources than we're transporting now. But transport will continue to be a major problem for this country, for the world. I understand 1 billion barrels of oil are daily on the high seas in transport somewhere. And that the issues we've tried to explore today transcend those issues of whether or not we're going to drill anywhere and really get down to the question of whether or not we can improve the transport of this and other hazardous cargoes that may indeed impact our environment and our lives. And to that end, we ask your continued help. We'll be exploring this issue of contingency response and oil spill liability extensively in the next weeks and months. We hope to get some legislation out. Now, you just went through the worst spill and some of the worst days that a company could possibly go through. in regard to this tragedy. The experience your people gain on the ground, not only from what you do right, but from what went wrong, will be invaluable to us. And if I can make one request of you as we thank you for your testimony and indeed appreciate the time you've shared with us, it is to indeed spend some time doing that for us, outlining what went right and what went wrong, and how you think as a company, as a corporate exec, this Congress can better minimize the risk of transportation of hazardous cargoes, as we will have to continue to rely upon transportation of hazardous cargoes from some source for this nation's economic well-being. In that regard, thank you again for your testimony, and if you will be so kind as to additionally submit to us that chronology of events so
that
we can compare it to what we've already put together, it will give us a better understanding indeed of what went right and what went wrong in regard to those critical hours following the tragedy. Mr. Rawl, thank you again for your time and for the courtesy of the attention you've given this committee. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I want to make them and the public aware that our subcommittee and the full committee,
ladies and gentlemen, the next set of witnesses will be from the resource agencies that are part of the National Response Team. And while the witnesses are taking their places at the table, I want to make them and the public aware that our subcommittee and the full committee will be revising our planned schedule for consideration of oil spill liability legislation. We expect now that hearings on H.R. 1465 will begin this month, with plans to bring legislation to the floor of the House for consideration in very short order following those hearings. So please be aware that Chairman Jones and I will be cooperating on a hearing schedule that will hopefully take us to the floor as rapidly as we can while this issue is so fresh in the minds of the public and in the concerns of the entire Congress. Today, we're joined in the resource panel by Mr. Kent Burton, Assistant Secretary of Commerce and Deputy Administrator of the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration, Mr. James Makris, who is Director of the Chemical Preparedness and Prevention Office, indeed Chairman of the National Response Team, and Mr. David Olson, who is Acting Assistant Director for Wildlife Resources, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Gentlemen, welcome. Mr. Burton, would you be so kind as to again, summarize your testimony. Your written testimony will be made a part of the record, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here today. It's been a long day. I will try and summarize as best I can. Facts of the spill have been, I think, well iterated this morning. I'll try and jump into what the role of our agency is and what we're doing. Prince William Sound, let me just rehearse maybe just a little bit about the geography there, which may give some context to what we're doing. As we know, the Prince William Sound is located on the south-central part of the Alaskan coast. It's a remote, pristine fjord estuary-type ecosystem, and it contains important natural resources, as we all know. At least five species of threatened or endangered marine mammals frequent the area during some time of the year. It's one of the largest undeveloped marine ecosystems in the United States, inhabited by only about 6,000 people in scattered towns, villages, and hamlets. The economy of the area is based on natural resources and includes at least the following: commercial fishing, which of course has been noted before the committee. The commercial fisheries include salmon, herring, as well as smaller fisheries of king crab, shrimp, and halibut. We estimate that these renewable resources each year are worth at least $100 million, probably more. Number two, recreation. Number three, subsistence fishing and hunting. Four, logging. Five, of course, oil transportation. Perhaps most devastating with the sad event was the timing of the spill. As the harsh Alaskan winter turns to spring, the irreplaceable resources of Prince William Sound are most in jeopardy. For example, migrating herring are finally in the sound and available for harvest during this time of year. The spill occurred, of course, just days before the scheduled opening of this fishery, which, as we know now, had to be canceled. This means not only lost jobs and income, but also lost export value to the United States. But more valuable even than herring is the salmon fishery. All five species of salmon are supported by Prince William Sound and its river systems. Adult fish will be affected when they return to the sound this spring and this summer. But juvenile salmon are now ready to enter the estuaries that have been damaged by the spill and will begin feeding on resources that have been themselves damaged. This is the time of their life cycle that they are most dependent on the marine environment impacted by the spill, and there's a good chance that many of these fish will not survive at all. The effects will be felt years down the road, we believe, when these fish are not available as adults for spawning, and the loss will likely ripple into the future. The effects of these natural resources and their human uses form the basis for the damage assessment work that will be undertaken by the co-trustees. In this case, NOAA acts on behalf of the Secretary of Commerce as a federal trustee for natural resources in coastal and marine areas. The Secretary of the Interior, the Secretary of Agriculture, and since, of course, this incident occurred in state waters, the state of Alaska, also have significant trustee interests. NOAA's damage assessment authority is derived from CERCLA, as it's called, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, as well as the Clean Water Act, and also other resource management statutes, which provide the legal and procedural framework for the claims. Based on these legal authorities, NOAA has four principal responsibilities during and after the spill. First of all, we're the scientific coordinator to the U.S. Coast Guard on the scene. Specifically, the coordinator of science does a handful of things. Number one, they provide liaison between natural resource, chemical, medical, and other scientific experts and the on-scene coordinator. Number two, we model trajectories of the spill, which has been an important role. Number three, we assess the nature, the behavior, and the fate of the oil pollutants. For example, chemical sampling and analysis, identification of toxic properties, and alteration of physical and chemical characteristics under various environmental conditions. Number four, we advise on safety precautions for response personnel. Number five, we identify areas of biological importance requiring protection. Number six, we help the on-scene coordinator respond to inquiries from local, state, and federal agencies for assistance in scientific studies and environmental assessments. And finally, we assist the on-scene coordinator in public relations interests. As a member of the regional response team, NOAA also assists in the preparation of federal recommendations to the coordinator. As a federal trustee for living marine resource, NOAA is also responsible for identifying injuries to resources, assessing losses associated with injury to natural resource, and bringing claims against the responsible parties. And finally, as the nation's principal marine pollution research and monitoring agency, NOAA examines the long-term ecological consequences of the spill. Let me note that we have about 25 experts on scene right now, including people from NOAA's Hazardous Materials Response Team, the National Marine Mammal Laboratory, the National Marine Fisheries Service Ok-Bay Laboratory, the Office of Aircraft Operations, the University of Alaska Sea Grant Program, and the National Weather Service. NOAA's hazardous material response experts have conducted extensive overflights of the spreading oil in coastal reaches of Prince William Sound to monitor the slick movement and identify threatened areas. I think it's fair to say that we are among the leading experts in the world with regard to understanding the movements and characteristics of oil spills. And our trajectory models are an important part of this, which form an important tool in spill response. Unfortunately, the impacts, I dare say, even at the early stage, are substantial, and I believe they will grow worse. The ecology of Prince William Sound is especially vulnerable to an oil spill of the magnitude of the Exxon Valdez. The innumerable rocky inlets and coves are traps where the crude oil is collecting and being deposited on the beach. Gravel beaches are particularly vulnerable to fouling. Because of many of the factors like this, the effects of the Exxon Valdez may be with us for quite a while yet. Mr. Chairman, it goes perhaps without saying that we at NOAA intend to be participants in the effort for the long haul. This is without a doubt the worst oil spill that has occurred in the United States history. And NOAA, we believe, has substantial capabilities that we are now using to address the critical problems caused by the disaster. We'll continue to assist the Coast Guard, the state of Alaska, and private interests in containing and, to the extent possible, repairing the damage done by the catastrophe. And, of course, we'll be willing to answer questions here. Thank you, sir.
I wish to have Mr. Makris, who is the Director of the Chemical Preparedness Prevention Office and also Chairman of the National Response Team with the EPA. Mr. Makris, would you please summarize your testimony, sir?
I am the Chairman of the National Response Team, and I think that it's been mentioned both by very kindly by the Chairman this morning as well as by Secretary Skinner and Admiral Yost. The National Response Team is composed of the 14 agencies, and the roles are delineated for each. NOAA just very adequately described the particular and unique role that it has in the areas of providing support and assistance to the on-scene coordinator, as well as providing the continued responsibility as a trustee. Within the agency, in addition to the National Response Team, we have an organization called the National Incident Coordinating Team, which has been activated for this event within the agency of EPA. And because this is primarily an environmental issue in many ways, we have as a co-chair of that operation, a director from the Office of Water. National Incident Coordinating Team is an internal EPA mechanism, sir. Yes, sir. I was privileged to travel with Administrator Riley, Secretary Skinner, and Admiral Yost to Alaska, and was able to ride in a helicopter with the governor of Alaska as we overflew this tragic scene. And I can surely identify with the terrible problem that it's presented environmentally and otherwise. In terms of the next actions that need to be taken out there, EPA's role, as you know, under the National Contingency Plan and within the NRT, is to support the designated on-scene coordinator. The National Response Team, with those 14 agencies, clearly states that the on-scene coordinator in this event, because it's a coastal event, would be the Coast Guard, and the National Response Mechanism identifies that a single point of contact must be made within the federal government to assure that there would be no question about who's in charge. Let there be none. In this case, for the response, the Coast Guard is in charge. And the other 13 agencies of the National Response Team mechanism, including EPA, are there to support the Coast Guard in this response effort. It was clear upon arrival that while a great many efforts might be taken by the agencies to deal with the cleaning up of this tragedy, an important effort would be to be sure that we learned lessons from it to assure that it would not happen again. It clearly taxed the mechanisms that we've had in place. It clearly was an enormous spill, and it clearly needs a careful analysis by all of us. Along those lines, Secretary Skinner, Administrator Riley, and Admiral Yost were tasked by the President of the United States to deal in detail with the lessons to be learned from this study. They were charged with delivering a 30-day report, which Secretary Skinner referred to this morning, which would deal not only with an analysis of the response actions that took place, but also the preparedness and contingency planning for the event. That report, which will summarize lessons learned and will deal with a complete analysis of this effort, will in fact be due to the President within 30 days. We would also expect to have the industry's input. I heard the Chairman talk about their own studies, and we would expect that this could all be consolidated. It is our view that we must continue to learn lessons from this program, and including starting to work on important issues that have been raised in this hearing this morning regarding in situ burning and regarding the use of dispersants, perhaps the use of biological agents that might in fact help to assist in the faster and prompt recovery. In addition, there's need to continue to review the technology of oil spill cleanup. I understand that Admiral Yost said this morning there is no oil pickup magnet. There is no such thing, but we must continue to strive to examine what might be out there that might be useful in this area. The last responsibility that the Environmental Protection Agency has in the direct cleanup would be to participate in any way with support to the trustee agencies and the United States Coast Guard as they carry out their assigned responsibilities. One major difference in this issue will be that the lessons that are discovered and the inadequacies both technologically and managerially that are noted will in fact be carefully followed up as a result of this obligation to report to the President. We would expect perhaps some new research to be conducted in the areas of oil spill cleanup. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Makris. I also welcome Mr. David Olson, who is the Acting Assistant Director of Wildlife Resources for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Mr. Olson.
I appreciate the opportunity to come before you this afternoon, and I'll summarize my comments. The oil spill has had an adverse and often fatal impacts on many species of wildlife in the Prince William Sound. The Fish and Wildlife Service has management authority over migratory birds, sea otters, while the National Marine Fisheries Service has authority over the other marine mammals and the fisheries resources of the area. None of the species or the Alaskan population of sea otters are listed on the Endangered Species Act. The scale of the spill's impact is just now starting to become clear. Our preliminary beach surveys have found 80 oiled birds per 100 meters of beach on some islands in the path of the spill. It is highly unlikely that most oiled birds can be recovered and cleaned, although we're making every effort to do so. We anticipate that 3,000 to 5,000 seabirds could be recovered and cleaned. If not recovered and cleaned, a high percentage of the birds that become heavily oiled will not survive. However, at this point in time, we have no estimate of the number of birds that may be killed by the spill. Eagles have been observed scavenging on oil-killed birds. Although no dead eagles have been found, the service believes that toxicity connected to oil-soaked birds could kill bald eagles. There are approximately 750 eagles in the Prince William Sound. An aerial survey conducted after the spill revealed about 90,000 seabirds in the Prince William Sound. Half of them were in the area impacted by the oil. Aerial surveys are not expected to produce accurate total population numbers since many of the birds will not be seen. In addition, over 100,000 birds nest on the Chiswell Islands, a group of islands within the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge to the southwest of the Sound. The first strings of oil have already been reached. These islands. Sea otters, the total population of the Sound is estimated at about 10,000 animals. The heaviest concentration, estimated at 4,000 to 5,000, is located in the southeast portion of the Sound. Fortunately, this area was not impacted by the oil. Approximately half of the sea otter population is likely to be impacted by the spill. If the spill changes direction and goes southeast, the situation could become worse. The Fish and Wildlife Service presently has 24 people committed to monitoring, cleanup, bird and otter rescue activities. We have two chartered boats, 16 people working to locate oil otters and bring them to the sea otter cleaning station operated by Exxon and Valdez. We are operating constant aerial surveys of the Sound to monitor the movement of oil and its relationship to the seabird and sea otter populations. Under current wind conditions and tide forecasts, the leading edge of the spill could reach Afog Neck and Kodiak Islands this weekend. Service personnel are currently identifying and prioritizing areas for protective efforts on these islands. Two service vessels are moved into the area to support the damage assessment activities. This will consist primarily of large-scale surveys to document the losses of seabirds and sea otters. An assessment of natural resource damages under the provisions of the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation Liability Act is being initiated. It is not yet possible to estimate the loss, the extent of these losses at this time. This concludes my statement.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Gentlemen, you in fact, Mr. Makers alluded to the statement earlier made in these hearings that there's no magnet to pick up oil, and that in fact we have a whole array of different approaches to dealing with an oil spill, including boom and pick up and dispersion and eventual cleanup of beaches and different ways of dealing with it. Do any of your departments allocate money to R&D in this critical area?
That's right. And if you let me speak to that, if you don't mind. Obviously not enough. For the most part, the technology, at least within the Environmental Protection Agency and the Coast Guard, the technology has not progressed at the rate it might have. Pardon me?
It really hasn't.
That's right. And
we're still using the same technologies that we read about years ago.
I think we move forward from a bale of straw and a bulldozer, but I'm not sure how much further sometimes when you look at a spill like this. But this kind of a spill is kind of the worst possible problem. It's a choppy, open sea kind of environment with a shoreline not far away, which presents both of the big problems. Hard to catch and damage when it gets away from you, rather than being able to roll out into the ocean and perhaps let nature take its cleanup course. In a conference in San Antonio specifically dealing with oil spills and oil spill technology, it was noted by some of the experts there that the technology had not been moving very far advanced. And it's not only the Environmental Protection Agency and NOAA and Commerce and Coast Guard's responsibility, but it also is a major responsibility
responsibility of industry to deal with the development of these technologies as well. I think that part of the output and the lessons learned will be to identify the technological gaps, managerial gaps, organizational gaps that exist, and to try to assign them, and to hope that industry will stand forward, and if they don't, for the federal government and other governments to kind of push into those areas of importance.
Well,
but I would hope that industry, excuse me, sir.
Well, I follow up on your point, and it's a good one, that industry has, if they're going to have the responsibility for the enormous cost of cleanup, certainly would have an interest in any new technologies that would not only cut that cost down, but do a better job and prevent some of the damages that might later have to be mitigated. It seems to me that maybe I can get you to make a recommendation to us. While we're putting together a better oil spill liability fund, should we not dedicate some portion of it to extensive R&D in this area?
It would seem to me that there would be a great advantage to dedicating some funds, but not if it's tended to cause industry to stand back and let the government carry the whole ball.
I understand that.
It seems to be terribly important that one recognize that a few million dollars spent over each of the last few years would have been a pittance in comparison to the enormous cost of this event. But we who have been in the natural disaster business, which is I was in before I joined EPA, have always noted that there's plenty of money to clean up and never enough money to get ready.
Would you like to jump in here,
maybe
Mr.
Maybe just a little bit. There's a heck of a lot we don't know. On the other hand, there are things that we do know. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't point out that there's been a fair amount of federal resources that have been dedicated to understanding basic things like how oil interacts with marine water, marine life. Indeed, in the Gulf of Alaska, there's a recently published volume, a copy of which we can submit to the committee, which makes an analysis of this very sort of thing. The OXIEP program, which I believe is funded by the Department of Interior, Outer Continental Shelf Environmental Assessment Program, if I recall the acronym, has dedicated over the years close to $100 to $120 million to this sort of understanding, not necessarily to develop a way in which a magnet can be produced to lift oil out of the water, but to understand the interactions between oil and marine resources.